Good afternoon to all of you that are encouraged. It's wonderful to be with you. We have a lot of traffic on the road right now. I think maybe an accident has occurred south of here. So be careful when you leave. If you want to spend the night or spend part of it here with us, it's fine with me. Hello to you in Vero Beach. It's good to have you speaking to you. I think the Branos in Fort Myers are tuned in, and I know there are a few island people that occasionally and routinely watch, and we have those people in their canoes that are going on a float trip tomorrow. I think you're tuned in as well, and to any others, we say hello and welcome. My wife reads books all the time. And one of them that she's been reading is Genghis Khan. And a lot has been uncovered about him in recent years. He's been kind of an enigma to most people, but some records have been discovered, and so some of those are coming to light. Another book that she's reading right now is The Founding Foodies. This is an interesting book. It's about our forefathers of our nation and how interested they were in food. And, of course, that very much interested me. So I've read a few parts of this book, and I found that our forefathers, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, really brought a cuisine to us that we still enjoy today. They have made their own mark on what we enjoy. The book has a lot of recipes in it from the 1700s, and it's so similar to what we cook today. A very interesting book. And reading through parts of it, I found the story of George Washington very, very interesting. George Washington, our founding president, and we might say the father of America, was a very unique man in many ways. Besides his height and wooden teeth, there are some other things about him that you may not know. He was very much interested in agriculture. And he might have been the first green machine that we ever had here in America. When he retired from being president, he went back to his Mount Vernon. And there he had 8,000 acres of tobacco growing. And he tried to make a go of it, having this tobacco harvested and then put on ships and sent away and sold. And it would sell, but there was so much in taxation and in tariff, so much in haulage, that he wasn't making enough. And so he wanted to find a better way to make more money. And that's where he found that the profit in tobacco was too little, and that there was profit in farming so that we could have the kind of food we would enjoy. So those 8,000 acres, he split up into five farms. And in those five farms, our founding father, George Washington, found a lot of exercise. In fact, the day that he came out of being the president, and he got up in the morning, he put on his farmer togs, and he had his overalls on, and he was out there in the farm. As the time was just changing in a lot of the world, he found that there were certain books being published in England, which he purchased, on the subjects of animal husbandry and even recycling waste. And so he found that there were some new things that people had been practicing much. One of them was composting. There was a book on composting, and this was a new idea. And then coupled with that a little later came interest in manure and how to take animal waste and turn it into something that would help your soil. So he read these books and then employed their teaching. And so finally on these five farms, he grew 60 different crops. 60 different types of crops, some of them grains, of course, clover, flax, cotton, potatoes, peas, beans, and on it would go. And he practiced in his herding and herding of sheep, selective breeding, so that the sheep were improved. They had a few bad ones in the flocks, and he would find where they were, and he would pin them, and they would be sold or slaughtered, and he kept improving his herds of sheep. And so it was with other things. He also kept four types of poultry: ducks, geese, chickens, turkeys. He had all those, and then, of course, he had the egg industry from those animals. Have any of you ever eaten a turkey egg? Oh, a few of you have. They're big. One is a serving. One is a serving. So he had quite an interest in things of making life better for him, and in fact for his whole household, because he had indentured servants, people he hired, and also slaves. And uniquely, when he died, in his will, he set all of his slaves free. And this is about 65, 70 years before the Emancipation Proclamation was made, at the time of Abraham Lincoln. So he let his slaves have freedom at his death. There was a specially designed mill at that time for grinding flour. And it was unique enough that it was trademarked and patented. And people couldn't just get it. You'd have to buy the rights to the patent, and he did buy some rights. And rather than just the typical stones to grind the grain, he sent to France and got some unique stones. And these could be challenged with weights to have a very coarse grain or a very fine grain or flour come through them. Most often at that time, when grain was ground, men would have to take the sacks on their backs, walk up a flight or on a ladder, and put it into the hoppers. And this mill that he purchased the rights to and was built was automated. And so it took the grain up, fed it into the hopper at the right rate, ground it, and then it had a sifting mechanism past that so that he could have the very finest of flours for such as pastries or the coarsest for kinds of things like cereals. And so he had this whole thing going along. And it was an amazing thing. Here our president was a gardener and a foodie. He really enjoyed eating the best that he could. And so it was also with that river that went by his front door, the Chesapeake. Now the Chesapeake runs into Chesapeake Bay. It's a rather large river. And there were a lot of fish in there, such as herring. And so he started fishing as well and had his men fish. And when he was doing this fishing, he did it by seines, which are kind of a conical shaped screen that the fish move into, and then that is pulled out of the water and harvested. And they started with 10-foot long seines. Now the seine did a very good job, but he could see there's a lot of fish in that river. So he decided to go from a 10-foot seine to a 20-foot seine. Now Mr. Fike knows all about this kind of netting of fish, and he knows what weight that can probably produce. And after that, of all things, he started linking them together until he got 500 feet worth out into the river, linked with ropes. And so he would catch about everything that is in the river, and he made a marvelous haul with that. And that was what he could salt down, and it was salted down and sold. Some of it was eaten, and some of it was sold to the West Indies. And certainly he wanted a brew. He wanted a beer at the end of the day, so he started a brewery. He brewed beer and porter, but he needed something for the evening meal, so he started a winery. And he had his own winery. And of course, there had to be something to go to bed on, so he needed a nightcap. So he started a distillery. And in fact, the distillery that he started was the largest distillery in America at that time. So guests really liked coming to his house, didn't they? He had everything for them to eat and to drink. At one point, in one of his escapades of making exports to the West Indies, he hired a man that had a ship called the Fairfax. It was a brigantine ship that's got two masts and a square sailing rigged to it. And they're a typical schooner that you would see in any kind of a drawing. But he had one of these schooners, and this captain took his Fairfax full of the goods of Washington to the islands. But he didn't come back with the money. He used the money some other way. So Washington sued him. And in court, he won. But since the man had no money, the court decided that he would give up the Fairfax and he would give that to Washington. So now Washington had a ship. And when he had this ship, the Fairfax, the first thing he did was rename it. He renamed it the Farmer. And so that lends us to the title of my sermon today. The title is The Farmer. George Washington planted seeds, harvested the earth. He took the fish out of the river. He managed his herds. He did so many things. Anyone that could do all of this, one might think about being jealous of him. He had all these men working for him, though. And it is said his wife was very involved, and she kept a big ring of keys for the whole property. And every day she'd go around unlocking the locks and telling people what to do and what for and so forth. And so they planted their seeds. I ask you, will the seed that has been planted in you, that you are to nurture, from whence you are sure to produce fruit, is that occurring in your life? Are you the farmer? And maybe asking it in a very particular way, where is the farmer in you? Remember your first garden? I remember mine outside when I was 9 years old, out the back porch. It was grass about the size of this lectern. I dug it over, and I planted zucchini. In Southern California, it produced gangbusters. We had a lot of zucchini. Remember your first garden as a kid? How many of you had a garden when you were a child? Almost all of us. As time went on, gardening became more important to families. It's been part of our family heritage. We've had different types of gardens in our lives. Joy and I have had small ones that we did container gardening in, postage stamp gardening, raised bed gardening, third of an acre gardening, rototiller gardening, big rows, big tomatoes, tall corn. We've done so much in different types of gardens. My grandmother grew her garden beside her store. And when you think back into your family, are there farmers in your heritage? Are there dairymen? Are there ranchers? Are there brewmasters? What do you have in your family where you can think back to people who produced from the earth and made the seed that was planted grow and produce fruit? Now that happened in a lot of our lives back when. Some of us today still plant our gardens. But it is important for you and I to realize a garden is being planted in us. A seed has been put into us. And it must produce fruit. Genesis 8:22 says, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. Seed time and harvest will never cease as long as there is this earth. And it certainly applies in the physical sense, but I want to multiply that in your mind today and think about it in the spiritual sense. We know that the rain will fall, it's falling now, and you find it then softens the earth and you can work the earth. We all have our various kinds of gardens. And some of you might just have that patio tomato out on the porch. Some of you might just be a rose or a flower in a pot. Others of you, some of you have nice gardens, big gardens. You can can from your gardens. They sustain you. And it is important for us to realize the parallels that happen between that home-style gardening and the gardening that God is doing in us. Hebrews 6, verse 7 says, "For the earth which drinks in the rain that comes often upon it, and then brings forth herbs meet for them to whom it is addressed, receives blessings from God." Now, in our own personal life, my wife has a small garden outside on the back porch of 12 pots. Each pot is for herbs. I think there's two that have maybe the same herb, but for the most part, they're all different varieties of herbs. And so when I eat my traditional scrambled eggs in the morning, I'll find often that she's clipped some basil, some tarragon, some chives, and she's used her bowl and knife from Alaska, chopped it fine, moved it into those scrambled eggs, and they're fragrant and they're delicious. Just out of some pots of herbs. Now you think about your life in that sense, and whatever your wife puts in her scrambled eggs for you, or what you fellows might put on the grill for your family. Because of course, grilling is a man's job, right? We're in charge of burnt offerings. And for all that we do, they still say, "Oh, that's good. Can't we be thankful?" But the earth is softened by that rain that comes. In our area, just a part of Zephyr Hills, we haven't had rain for a few days. It's been all around us. Last night it fell, and I was so glad, because otherwise it was time to turn on the watering system. And when it falls, sometimes it falls real heavily, and sometimes it doesn't. But going back to the time when you found yourself with your garden, and you looked out there and Dad said, "Okay, I'll let you have this." And so you started digging. You dug it out, you pulled the weeds, you took the clumps of grass, you shook out the dirt, and you put all these vegetation that was going in a pile so that you could have good dirt. And you spaded it. And then you found if you took your shovel, you could now spade deeper. You could almost get a foot deep with that spade. And you made all that dirt soft. And then you found yourself with a rake, raking out the clods, the stones. Some of the clods you'd look at and you'd break them, put them back into the earth in their parts. You'd look at the worms and, "Yeah, I've got some worms, it's going to be good." And as this went on, you continued working with the soil. You might have put in some compost, perhaps some sand, perhaps it needed some other elements of the earth. Perhaps Randy gave you some ideas of where you should buy what you needed in that earth. But you formed then your bed to grow your food, your flower, whatever it was. And in this activity, you finally decided that you would plant in a hill, or you would plant in rows, and you went and got your seed, tomato, bean, peas, whatever it was, and you planted. And you strung a string so you could have a straight line. Dad told you it had to be a straight line. And you planted them just as the instructions said, 3 inches apart, tapped down lightly. And at the end, you put that stake with the little sign that was on the packet of seeds. It said beans, green beans. We've all done that. And after you planted it, you watered it. You weeded as you could. You saw some coming up that were not productive. They just seemed to be a plant. There was no flower on them. So you picked them. And finally, after 60 days, you could harvest your green beans. And you took this pitiful handful into the house, and it went into supper. We've all done that. But we must understand it is to happen in our life spiritually. You have to make your life straight. Your rows have to be straight. You have to be weedless. You can't have suckers taking up the strength of the soil. Water is going to come into that soil that you would put there. And water will come into your life by God's goodness. The seed from God is given to us. And while we walk through these days that we have, we must weed our lives. We must get the weeds out. In Luke 7, verse 62, Luke 7, 62. Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. If there's anything about a garden, especially the first one you planted, is to be patient. You'd look at it every day. Finally, you get bored of looking at it every day and you forget about it for a week and all of a sudden there's something there. But be patient then, brothers, unto the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. Growing up in Wyoming, the value of rains at the proper season for wheat is unbelievable. These large farms can lose a whole crop without the moisture properly coming to it. So you too be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. But it is near, it is coming. And so while we think about what we've done as children, what we thought about as we were adults with a bevy full of kids, and we've planted and we've taken the harvest, and we've been patient, there was always yield in that garden. If there wasn't yield, we threw up our hands and didn't garden again. And that was wrong. You needed to find out why it wasn't producing and make it work. And so it is with your life today. If you're not producing what you feel you can and that you should, change that life. Find out what needs redirection. Because you need to bring fruit. The yield must be there. There are times when you wonder about other people. Do they really understand it? It's time that you wonder about yourself. We're 110, 120 strong sometimes. Do half of us get what's going on? So we find in James 5, 7, Jesus said, James 5, 7, you know it. You don't have to write it down, I don't think. No one who puts a hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of God. When you started that job of taking care of that first garden or that large garden, you couldn't look back. You had to keep taking care of it. And your life needs continual care. Because you have age, that's no reason to stop. I'd like to have a vacation, take off a few years, sit in a chair, watch the Rays win. You know, up there, the water people, you guys in the canoes, Rays are winning. Here we are, though. Are we moving forward, changing our lives? In Luke 12, verses 16 through 21, Luke 12, 16 through 21 is a story of an old chap who had a bumper crop. And he looked at his fields, and it was more than anybody could possibly have enjoyed. And there was no place for him to put that kind of grain. I remember when I was a kid driving through a corner of Nebraska, going back home from Grandma's, and we went through Morrill, a little town that's there. And you look down the street, and all of Main Street was filled with yellow corn, taller than the buildings, and there was barely room for cars to go down each side. Not enough room to put the corn. So they filled Main Street. Those things have happened. And there's people that have found in their lives they've been filled with God's Spirit and have gone down and had that kind of harvest. Well, this guy had a big harvest, so he had too much, so he tore down his barns, tore down his silos, and said, well, I got to do something. And so he built them big, and then he sold it because he wanted to have his life easy. He wanted to take it easy. He wanted to drink. He wanted to put his feet up. Now, in most of the parables, usually someone else is symbolically representing God the Father. But this isn't representing God the Father. This guy who has the bumper crop is called into account, and God himself says, "You fool! This very day your life will be demanded of you." So we must be about the business of change. We must be about our Father's business. The parable ends with verse 21. It says, "This is how it will be for everyone who stores up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God." So as we try to become a little bit more personal in these thoughts, are you a crop for the farmer? It's a kind of a unique thing. That mighty Chesapeake River supplied many fish for Washington. He used them to feed his family, to send them to market, to export. Every farmer needs water. Even the dry land farmer needs water. Some others who supply foods, like fishermen, take their harvest from water. If you're growing grapes or anything to make your wine, you need water. As George Washington is the father of our nation, the King of all nations will return. The King of kings and Lord of lords. And he will have water with him. And he'll be evaluating how those that have been given water are using their water. Whether they've been good farmers. I'm not talking about anything you haven't heard before, but I think the analogy, digging with the spade and being one who cares for the earth, is simple enough and personal enough that we can understand that deeply. Sometimes it is important to just take note of ourselves. You know, George Washington harvested his crops. The father of America. The father of all nations will harvest his crops. He will see who has accepted the water and grown. Water is symbolic of God's Holy Spirit. There's a movie that I really enjoyed, some of you others might have, called A River Runs Through It. Something that was I could have an identity with because it was shot in the areas of Montana where the Missouri River goes through. And I fished the mighty Missouri up there. It's not like what comes out down here. It's clean. You can see to the bottom. It's a heavy running Beautiful river, very powerful river. And the only way you can fish on that river is with a guide. And the only fishing that's allowed is fly fishing. And I've flied fish a few times on the Missouri. And when you're doing that, he runs his boat, oars it for you, no power craft at all allowed, moves it down, moves it against a bank, uses the current to say, for there, use the red fly. And you whip it around, you whip it around, and finally you release it, and you hope you've hit it right. And if you do, you get a brown 20 inches long. And there starts the pleasure, bringing in that fish. You can get rainbow and browns there, at cutthroats even, but the whole thing is catch and release. And so you bring it up, you show it to everybody else that's sitting around in their boats, then you let it swim off. Back into the water, back to grow some more. So when I think of a river runs through it, I think about how pleasant it is to catch something beautiful and then to release it and watch it grow more. Every one of you are beautiful. You have been caught, and he slipped you into the river. And it is for you then to continue growing. Now, the vision of the holy waters in Ezekiel 47 isn't often turned to. It's difficult to understand because it's so big. It talks about in the future that there's going to be out of Jerusalem and out of the temple some mighty gushing water that is unbelievable in strength, in power, in ability. And that water that comes gushing out from underneath that throne room, some of it's got a head start dribbling into your life. So 47:1 of Ezekiel. Afterward he brought me again into the door of the house. Behold, the waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward, for the forefront of the house stood towards the east. And the waters came down from under it from the right side of the house, at the south side of the altar. Then brought he me out of the way to the gate northward, and he let me by that way without it unto the utter gate by the way that looks eastward, while the water ran out there on that right side too. And when the man had the line in his hand, he went eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits. He brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the ankles. Still called them ankles back then. And he measured 1,000 more and brought me through the waters, and it was to my knees. 1,000 more he brought me through the waters, and they were to my loins. After he measured 1,000, it was a river that I could not pass over. The waters were risen, waters to swim in. They were so deep. And he said unto me, Son of man, have you seen this? He brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. And so I went on to the bank, and looking at everything, it came to pass, I'm in verse 9, that everything that lives, which moves, whatsoever the river shall come, shall live. And that speaks to your life today. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come here, for they shall be healed. And everything that lives, whether the river, wherever the river comes, there's healing. And you can read on through verse 12 to get the whole interest of the section. I want to turn with you, though, to Matthew 25. Verses 14 through 30 you can read, but I think you're familiar with the story. It's about a man that's going to take a journey. Matthew 25:14. He called his servants and entrusted them with his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. Each according to his ability. And that is something God understands about us. He understands that we have different abilities. But we still have ability. Well, that one that received the 5 went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 other talents. So also with he that had the 2, he made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Symbolic of what has been hid for us. You must produce because you are being farmed. If we go back to our little personal analogy, you know, when you were working your garden, after a while, and maybe you were once employed working in a strawberry field. We've all done different things. But sooner or later, someone put a hoe in your hands. Either your dad, your mom, or they told you, go back there in the corner of the garage, get the hoe, and start hoeing. And you try to make then all of these rows proper once again, because maybe the water has washed them. And every so often you see a weed or you see some grass trying to grow. And what do? You hoe that out. You see something that's not quite right. That's not a radish. What is that? I don't know, but I'm going to take the hoe and get after it. And you work with that hoe. There's an analogy there, isn't there? So in Revelation 22, the first 5 verses, the things that you can read in Ezekiel 47 about this water that comes out of the throne room is covered again in this last chapter of Revelation. In these first 5 verses, it says, he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there a tree of life, bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. And he shall see his face, and his name should be in their foreheads. And there shall be no night there, no need of a candle, neither light of sun, for the Lord gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. So that water is going to be coming out even in the days of Revelation, looking forward to that prophecy. So we must remember ourselves in this whole picture. You are a plant in the garden of God. If you do not produce, the hoe will get after you. You get cold, your roots are exposed, and you leave. You go do something else. And it says they're no good but to be put on the fire and just burn them up. It's very clear that we must produce the fruit. And it is so tough sometimes. But we must do the right thing. So in conclusion, I want you to remember God wants us to be clear in realization that he's going to farm the earth. He's going to reap his crop of covenant believers. And he's going to drag his hoe across the nations of this world. You don't want to get caught in that hoe's action. Now, the fall holy days that we're coming to picture the time when all that action takes place. Right now, we're in the time of Pentecost. God's Spirit has been given to us. And we must be about the business of using that Spirit. As we move forward, we grow, take advantage of what has been given to us in a proper sense, and manufacture something that is honorable and true and good. Character. In a concluding text, let's look at Zechariah 14. And it's 21 verses. We're going to go through each of them. And in it, you're going to find reference by word and topic to the four qualities of a kingdom. You're going to find interest here in the people, law, territory, and the king. And I've been mentioning this many times in the last 2 years, that the four qualities of a kingdom are being established. And God then knows who's going to be in his covenant people. Because he has made the covenants, the promises, that are sure and everlasting, that his government will come to this world. It will be upon his shoulders. And he's going to be wonderful. The counselor. He is going to be clearing the way with his law. He's going to have people keeping that law in the territories he assigns to them. So in Zechariah 14:1, where it tells us the Lord will fight the nations, a day is going to come for the Lord when the loot you have taken will be divided among you. I'm reading from the God's Word translation. It's a more up-to-date, perhaps easier to follow. Verse 2, and I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem for battle. So all the people, all from every land, the city will be captured, the houses looted, the women raped. Half of the people in the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people won't be taken from the city. Then the Lord, talking about who is the King of Kings, who will be the leader. He will go out and fight against those nations as he does when he fights a battle. Four, and on that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, just east of Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives will be split in two, forming a very large valley from east to west. Half of the mountain will move towards the north, the other half will move towards the south. Then you will flee to the valley of my mountains, because this valley between the mountains will go as far as Azel. You will flee as you did from the earthquake in the time of King Uzziah. And the Lord my God, so the king is the one mentioned, will come, and who is with him? All the holy ones, all of his people. They will be with him. And on that day there will be neither heat nor freezing cold. There will be one day, a day known to the Lord, with no difference between day and night, will be light even in the evening. And so then we talk about the living water from Jerusalem in verse 8. And on that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem. So Jerusalem tells us that there will be this land, this holy seat, and half of it towards the Dead Sea and the other half towards the Mediterranean Sea. It will continue in summer and in winter. The Lord will be king over all the earth. The king is once again mentioned. And on that day, the Lord will be the only Lord, and His name, the only name. So the whole earth, all lands, will become like the plains from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate, then to the corner gate, and then from the tower of Haniel to the king's wine presses. So it gives us some demographics, so we see it's got a place. And people, that portion of the kingdom that is necessary, people will live there and will never be threatened with destruction. Jerusalem will live securely. Then there's going to be a plague that the Lord will use to strike all the people from the nations that have gone to war against Jerusalem. Those that refuse to conform, that refuse the waters of transition. Their flesh will rot while they are standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. Now, we could hyperbole that this maybe is nuclear. You don't need to go that far. God can do anything He needs to do to make any kind of destruction. All He has to say is, let it be, and it is. This earth is an example of that. 13, and on the day a large-scale panic from the Lord will spread among them. One person will grab the hand of another, another will attack the other. Judah will also fight in Jerusalem. The wealth of all the surrounding nations, so everything that is against God, will be collected, and a very large amount of gold, silver, and clothes. A similar plague will also affect horses, mules, camels, donkeys, and all other animals in those camps. Everyone who is left from all the nations that attacked Jerusalem will come every year then to worship the king, the Lord of armies. It's one of the ways that he is considered the Lord of armies. And to celebrate the Feast of Booths. So the laws deciding the timing of God's feast will be kept. And if any of the family of the earth won't go to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of armies, then rain won't fall on them. If the people of Egypt won't go or enter Jerusalem, then rain won't fall on them. The plague the Lord will use it to strike the nations will affect those who won't come to celebrate the Feast of Booths. This will be the punishment for Egypt's sin and for the sin of all nations that won't go to celebrate the festival of booths. Transgression of law is sin. So God's law will be there. And on that day, holy to the Lord will be written on the bells of the horses. And the cooking pots in the house of the Lord will be like the bowls in front of the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to the Lord of armies. All who come to sacrifice will take some of them and cook in them. And on that day there will no longer be any Canaanite, any unbeliever, anyone that is a transgressor against God's ways. None of them will be in the house of the Lord of armies, the king. Now you think about it. You garden in your own little way as a child. A little later you garden in a more masterful way, as you had opportunity. And in all of this, there's a gardening that takes place in your life as well. A seed has been planted in you. It has been watered. You have been given God's Spirit so that you can grow. And you can produce fruit. So it's important that you know that. That you do that. He has put you in a place where your root can grow. You don't want a hoe pulling you from the earth because you're just a sucker, or you've withered, or you've been compromised by weeds, and you've been around weeds and you refuse to leave the weeds. The people of God will change. they will allow themselves to be farmed. As you farmed the soil in your days of old, or even today, realize right now you are being farmed by God.